My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Mikhail Gorbachev, his passing is a wonderful opportunity to reflect on what he achieved and what has been lost. I welcome Judy Dempsey, Carnegie Europe. She is the editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe. And the publication gathers the voices across the European Union. Right now we're looking at a memory of the 20th century under the Soviet Empire, not only in Russia, but also across Eastern Europe, capitals that have enjoyed prosperity these last decades. And so sometimes when you visit, it's hard to see the want, the deprivation, the fear that also existed in those same spaces. I one day sat down in a marketplace in Krakow, in Poland, and saw the young people out in the sunshine enjoying, just as if it was Paris or London or Berlin, an afternoon of reflection around ancient buildings, and tried to imagine what it was like, a gray and fear and rain and black market. Well, it's impossible. So I welcome Judy to reflect upon what Gorbachev achieved and what we now know as the take it for granted part of perestroika that has slipped away in these months of conflict in Ukraine. Judy, a very good day to you. What did Gorbachev mean to Europe before the exit of the Soviet Empire? What was his hope from 1985 until his departure in 91? How did that come to Europe?
The rise of Gorbachev, who became the last president of the Soviet Union, was viewed with astonishment, surprise, hope, expectation, and a yearning for some change. Because despite the gradual changes in the Eastern Bloc, which was under the Soviet Union, it was in a kind of icebox. And the perspective of change wasn't really there. And Gorbachev gave it with his opening up, with Glasnost, with the media, with dealing with Solzhenitsyn, Sakharov. It was an astonishing time. And the ripple effects across Eastern Europe were just so exciting. And I was there at the time.
Yes, you write of change and hope. And when the Soviet Union was dissolved at the end of 1991, there was the expectation that prosperity was ahead. Slowly, over those months and years, different parts of the Eastern European Soviet Empire had liberated themselves. You write of one particular moment that seems almost theatrical in its irony, a visit by Gorbachev to the capital of Romania. Then, under the extreme repression of the Ceausescu regime, and a fruit market that was well stocked. And what happened after the cameras left to that fruit market, Judy?
This was in Bucharest, and there was no love lost between the former dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu, and Gorbachev. And I remember in the 1990s that the markets were completely empty. People were starving, or certainly hungry, power shortages, rationing and so on. And for that special visit of Gorbachev to the market, the stalls were packed with food I have never seen before for several years in Bucharest, neither did the public. Gorbachev was shown the market, pride by the Ceausescu family and the Securitate. And as soon as he left and the entourage left, the crowds stormed into the market and grabbed anything they could buy. And it was an extraordinary moment of you could call it a material hope that many Romanians knew that perhaps Gorbachev could bring change. But it was this extraordinary atmosphere of one day the markets were empty, the next day they were full, the next day there was a stampede, and minutes later all the food was gone again and there was nothing the next day.
And yet there was brutality under Gorbachev's time as well. You note of an incident in January of 91 when the authorities opened fire on Lithuanians and several were killed. I believe there was an incident in Baku later on that year that galvanized fear.
Yes, and indeed the death of Gorbachev wasn't particularly treated with a lot of huge sadness in Lithuania. They still resent how many were shot dead when they went to protect the radio and television station. And so there was a bit of ambiguity in the Baltic states about the passing away of Gorbachev. And in Baku, there was a repression as well. The point is that what did Gorbachev inherit? He inherited such a one-party system of kleptocracy, of corruption, of one power, of no accountability. And to change this overnight, to make this transformation, was an astonishing, brave thing to start. And nobody could predict what would happen because the state institutions were not ready for this. They weren't built for this. They were built for the one-party state, not gradual democracy.
The irony also of Gorbachev opened the archives of the Soviet era. And let's come to today. That was then he opened the archives. Vladimir Putin, three times elected president of Russia, closes Memorial, which was an NGO dedicated to the information from those archives. Did we take those openings, that lifting of repression, that hope, did we take it for granted? Is the blame on us, Judy, for not paying attention?
This is very difficult to answer. Perhaps we were lured into a false sense of security that now that the Soviet system had collapsed and the one-party rule had collapsed and Eastern Europe had been liberated, that was it. They were on the road to democracy. This is the first thing. So we became intellectually, I suppose, complacent. Some of us did. Many were absolutely fascinated and curious by how Gorbachev did open the archives. Because if you don't look at the past, you cannot look at the present and plan for the future. And if you don't look at the past, you have a distorted view and a selective view of what your history is. And so under Putin now, the archives have been closed again, restricted certainly, and history is being rewritten, almost glorifying the Stalinist era and nearly whitewashing it and being very not even ambiguous about the Gorbachev era. But essentially, the past is now the Putinization of the past rather than the past being open to independent research to examine what happened to Russia after 1917 during the Stalinist era and now, and where do we go from here?
The Maastricht Treaty, my history is patchy here, so help me, Judy. The Maastricht Treaty, I believe, was 1991, and that was the foundational document for what we now see as the European Union. Born at the same time that the Soviets exited, was the presumption of the European Union in the late 20th century and early 21st century that it had replaced the Soviet repression with an era of prosperity? Did everybody assume there'd be no going back?
I remember the feelings at the time. There was an assumption that the Cold War era is over. And so, as I said earlier, this was the transformation now would take hold. And I think what the West Europeans forgot or didn't understand was the whole structure of society had been ossified. The whole structure of power had been a power invested in a one-party state. And then the transformation requires a middle class. It requires an economic class. It requires a civil society, the rule of law, independent judiciary, accountability. None of these things existed and they had to be built. And I think there was a kind of intellectual complacency among the West. Eastern Europe will be like us and they'll manage. Everything will be fine.
And today, looking back upon this, because we learned from our blindness, our mistakes. I cannot speak for the U.S. other than to say there was no focus on the idea that we could slip backwards just in a moment. Is there despair, Judy, about Ukraine because of what's been lost, that hope and change of 91? Do people talk about it?
It's not despair about Ukraine now among civil society. And strong political elites and strong democracies in Europe. I mean, there's an extraordinary excitement that the Ukrainians as a nation can A, rediscover their nation, B, actually really fight for something that is absolutely vital to them. Sovereignty, their independence, the rule of law and values. This is what is at stake now. And in some ways, Russia's war in Ukraine has shown to Europeans who have lived in democracy for a long time, the East Europeans until from 1991, that actually a country is willing to defend itself. So in that sense, there is an immense admiration for what Ukraine is doing among most countries in East, among most countries in Europe. But inside the EU, there are countries that actually are not defending the democracy. In fact, their leaders are undermining it and the rule of law and accountability.
Then I can regard that hope and change of the Gorbachev era in 91 as returned in the hope and change for what can happen after the Ukraine conflict. Is that how to regard this? That Ukraine can finally slough off the remnants of the Soviet era?
This Ukraine conflict is really about the future construction of Europe. This war is really about which direction Ukraine is going to go. If Ukraine wins, it will have a domino effect for Belarus, where the dictator Alexander Lukashenko relies on Putin to stay in power. It will be a galvanizing moment for the young leadership in Moldova, which is trying to be pro-Western, pro-European, and in Georgia and in the other countries. The domino effect could be extremely positive. And Europe will have to be ready for this to reach out much more and integrate these countries. If Russia did win or impose a negotiated settlement or have a frozen conflict, it would be a disaster for Eastern Europe. This would be an attempt to reconstruct some kind of control over the former Soviet space. Reformers would be isolated. Russian propaganda, patriots, nationalists, the whole atmosphere would change in the region, making it very unstable, very insecure, and would have huge repercussions for the European Union, which would have to deal with this instability, not that it's stable at the moment on its borders.
I'm speaking with Judy Dempsey, the editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe, which is part of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Judy's in Berlin, and we're going to turn to a question she's put to her colleagues about a very small part of the Soviet Eastern European Empire, but critical to understand where the European Commission, the European Union is today, asking the question, is the EU too soft on Hungary? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here, wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes of network busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.